Todd, say hello and welcome. You're listening to the voices of our people on the Windspeaker Radio Network. I'm Daniel Barker Trombley at Sea Got Sued. On today's episode, I continue my conversation with Julia McDougal from Mikisew Cree First Nation. With the help of your impact to their lives as well, to walk across and grace that stage to also accept the Eagle Feather, but you've also done a lot of involvement with the Full Circle Mentoring Program with Big Brothers and Big Sisters of Wood Buffalo back in 2009, which is still being offered to students today. Can you talk a little bit about your involvement within the Full Circle Mentoring Program?
Well, that was back in 2009, like you said. Of course, I was still working at the high school at Concert High, and some gentleman that was working for the Wood Buffalo, the community center anyway, they had a grant for, an X amount of money. They had a grant, and then they were trying to pull committee members, community members together, and they wanted to start a little program. So that's what we did. We sat together as a committee member. We had an elder sit with us, and then we talked, we discussed what should be, offered, because in some schools, they don't have, Cree class and so forth, or Aboriginal studies. So we started this after-school program that we got the students involved, the grades 3s and 4s. And we also, at that time, we had the high school students involved. So they were the mentees. So they helped with the program. And they did crafts. They did a lot of things, played games and stuff like that. And it's still happening today. Of course, I stepped away, and other people just take over, and the program still runs to this day.
And, from being in that mentoring program, do you have any moments that you've had with interactions within that program that stood out to you that you'll always remember or be fond of?
We're there as adults, coordinating this program. But what I used to find was little kids, they love playing, they love the crafts and so forth. But what I found was when we brought the teenagers come in there, they're almost looking up to the teenagers. The teenagers are the role models for them. That stood out a lot to me. And now these teenagers that were involved in there, they're adults now. They have their own families.
And of course, not that long ago, back here in December or January, we also got to witness the Wood Buffalo hosting the Arctic Winter Games, which showcased a lot of Indigenous games, such as, stick games, as well as Dene hand games and so forth, along with a lot of Indigenous competitors from the Northwest Territories, from the Yukon, and all over Alberta as well. Were you able to witness that? And if so, what does that mean to you to see Indigenous culture being showcased on a big stage like that?
I think it was phenomenal. We had it was so good to watch the different games, but especially the hand games. I think that was a big hit. Recently here, we hosted our own Dene hand games in our schools, the high schools, and the elementary schools. And the kids loved it, and it wasn't just for the Aboriginal students as well. We invited all nations to come play the hand games, and we're going up to High Prairie here soon because one of the teams won, so they're going to go up to High Prairie to do a hand game competition in High Prairie here next month.
And when you see stuff like that, like the Dene hand games becoming almost like a synonymous event that can be hosted in almost every school for just not even just Indigenous people, but also non-Indigenous people to participate as well. What does it mean to see something like that happen within school bodies?
They have such fun. The students, when they see that, they're learning a lot. They're just having fun with it. The Dene hand game is just the one game. And we've hosted another Indigenous game on numeracy. The counting sticks. There are so many that I was involved in hosting for games, under numeracy. And how they learn as they play, the stick game, they have a game called stick game. It's counting.
Mm-hmm.
When I was teaching Cree, grade 3, I remember one year I taught grade 3 Cree class. And then we used to play this one game called stick game. And it was just, you know, counting sticks and stuff like that. It's a really, for them, it was a cool game. They called it the grade threes. But the English teacher one day, or the math teacher one day, came to me and said to me, what are you doing with your students? What are you doing with our students? Because these grade threes, I only had about 12 students at the time, would come to my class for half an hour and they'd go back to their math class or whatever. And she would was teaching them math. I think she was teaching them about grouping, you know, grouping whatever. They're doing some a skill on grouping. But those 12 kids that were coming to my classroom for the Cree class and playing that game, they're catching on, like, so quickly, you know, and she couldn't believe it. She said, what are you doing with them? And it was just by playing that one game, that indigenous game. Like the kids were playing, but they were also learning without even knowing.
And in regards to, you know, such events like that that happen within Fort McMurray, are there any projects that you have coming up that you would like to integrate or get more involved in within the Wood Buffalo area?
Well, right now, like I said, the hand games are really, really big right now. So we're hoping to, like, have games and compete against, like, even the other school districts, because there's three school districts within this area. There's the Fort McMurray Public, of course, for Catholic schools, and then the Northland School Division as well, you know. So that can be a whole, like, there's so many schools around here that we can host hand games and so forth. And then, of course, we still going to the land-based learning camps as well, you know, overnight land-based camps. That's big, too.
And, of course, you had said it in an interview way back when that, you know, you were talking about your vision for Indigenous programming is not only that the school district will continue educating students and staff, but also the general public about the true history of Canada's First Nations people and, of course, their many contributions. And so with that vision, are you starting to see that vision come to light in today's times? You know, with the Truth and Reconciliation Movement, the Orange Shirt Days, and, of course, just the integration of the teachings of the cultures across the province of Alberta and Canada.
It is so, yes, we start from the schools, right? But, you know, to me, I always say, especially for the teachers, they have to know the culture to be able to teach some of the, you know, the knowledge of our people. So we have to educate the teachers first and foremost. I had the privilege of working with the Alberta Teacher Association. They seconded me back in 2016, and we did some resources for our teachers because Truth and Reconciliation was right at our doorstep, you know, and then the teachers have to integrate that into the school system. So that was a great experience for me. I was there for two years developing resources. But the general public is, I think, needs to know a lot about our Canadian history. And with ATC holding those cultural camps, and it's open to everybody, I think that's very important. That's how people learn about different cultures. Not only the missing, murdered woman or Orange Shirt Day, like, we have to celebrate our culture, what we know as people, what kind of, you know, what we learn as people, the goodness of people.
And, of course, it benefits everyone as well. You know, when I went to school, and even while I was going through my K-12, there maybe be only a couple of pages in a textbook talking about Indigenous culture, the Métis, the Dene, the Stoney, the Blackfoot, everybody that was involved both on Treaty 6, 7, and 8 territory. And now that we see this movement happening of the Truth and Reconciliation and everything else that's going on, we're starting to see a differentiating shift, as you could say, that's happening across the province, as well as, you know, we're seeing more, as you said earlier, hunger for the teachings and everything else. Have you worked alongside, Fort Chip and Fort McKay and also the Indigenous communities within Fort McMurray to come up with more ways to help teach and educate those that have Indigenous background, but also those that don't have Indigenous background as well?
Yeah, when I was first, there was a program I worked for Fort McMurray First Nations back in 97. We just started. And there was a program called Bridging the Gap. We work within the schools. And it's, you know, where they started off slowly, like doing Aboriginal Day. Like they have an Aboriginal Day once in May or something like. But now it's like every month in the schools anyway, that we have different themes. Like September would be Eagle Moon, Eagle, you know, the seven teachings, I guess. So there's a lot of integration now within the schools, and then the teachers are learning along with the students. And, you know, and we just got to keep doing this every day, you know, keep moving forward, teaching other people that don't know our culture and they live here in this beautiful country of ours.
And of course, I have to ask, you know, with your other fellow teachers, you know, learning as well as the students are that may not know about the culture, what has been the overall reception from them that want to know and to know more about how to educate those about the Treaty 7, the Treaty 8, and of course, Indigenous members on province land here in Alberta?
Well, there's a lot of resources now for the teachers to access, you know, which is really helpful for them, because at one point there was not that much resources about. Well, I'm just going to talk about Alberta, I guess. When we did a lot of resources, there's a lot of resources on the different nations, right? It's not just Cree, it's not just Dene, right? There's so many different nations, and there is a lot of resources for the teachers to want to know, and of course. The media, like the YouTube, has a lot of good resources as well there for anybody, for that matter.
I also have to ask as well, I read in a web story that somebody wrote on you that you were smiling from ear to ear when students were taking in Bannock for the first time. What was your reaction to seeing those that haven't experienced Bannock before? They ask the question of, what is that? That looks like bread.
Yeah.
So what was your reaction to that?
It was like, to them, the student, they loved it. We taught them about the fire, right? The sacredness of the fire. And there's always teachings behind everything. And then the kids just loved baking the bannock. And that's the only station they wanted to go to. There was different other stations, like the medicine pouch. And then the elder took them for a walk in the woods to teach them about the different medicines that they can use. They got lost in the forest and so forth. Like, there's so much teachings out there, not just in a classroom.
And of course, as well, as an Indigenous instructor yourself, have you also gone on to teach the students, both Indigenous and non-Indigenous, about the importance of smudge and practicing ceremony and the protocol that follows with it as well?
Yeah, right now I'm teaching Aboriginal Studies 10, grade 10 students. We talk about spirituality and the difference between spirituality and religion, you know. And then over the years, I've taken to ceremonies. Of course, we had to get consent from the families. So I would take them to different ceremonies, like the sweat ceremony even they participated in. I've done smudge ceremonies in the mornings. I still do that in class. I sometimes take them outside when the weather's nice. But my school is very supportive where I'm allowed to use a smudge in my classroom.
That was Mikisew Cree First Nations Julia McDougall. You're listening to the voices of our people on the Windspeaker Radio Network. I'm Daniel Barker-Tremblay. Next, I sit down and talk with Madam President of Métis Nation of Alberta, Audrey Patra. Can we start off? Here we go. So, Todd, say hello and welcome. You're listening to the Voices of Our People on the Windspeaker Radio Network. I'm Daniel Barker-Tremblay, Nitsigatsun, and on today's show, I am honored to speak with Madam President Audrey Patra from Edmonton, Alberta. I'm Scott Tanoa. Welcome there, Audrey.
Thank you very much, Daniel. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
And now, Audrey, I have to ask, you know, before we get to the meat and potatoes, we got to start from the beginning. So, you know, having family ties within Fishing Lake Métis Settlement and, of course, within Edmonton as well, who are some of your people, that role models in life that helped shape you into the person that you are today?
On the Métis Settlement side, my dad's family was one of the first families on the Fishing Lake Métis Settlement, although as our family, my dad's family, we never lived on the settlement. All of his siblings were there, and some are still there. So I have many cousins and aunties and uncles that my cook-em lived on the Métis Settlement. So that's where my settlement connection comes in, is from the Dumont family on the Métis Settlement. So your second part of your question, for the second part of your question,
Yes. Who were some of your role models that, you know, helped shape you to the person that you are today?
You know, I believe I had many role models in my life. I had my dad, who was a very proud Métis man. Even though we lost our dad, I was only 11 years old when my dad passed away. I learned a lot from him. I followed him everywhere. I did some of the things that maybe people thought only boys were supposed to do at that time. But I followed my dad hunting and trapping and out in the farmyard and everywhere else. So my dad truly taught me a lot about ourselves as Métis people, just by doing. My mom is not Métis. She comes from an English family who immigrated to Canada, and my mom was the only member of that family who was born in Canada. She married my dad, and because of becoming a teacher, and her first teaching place was out at Fishing Lake Métis Settlement.
And of course,
and she
Go ahead. Sorry.
And that's where she met my dad. Of course, I have many more role models that have certainly helped shape who I am. My mom's oldest sister was like another mother to us, and was always there for us when my mom was busy teaching. As I became an elder, as I became older, and as an example, became the president of the Métis Nation, Delia Gray was an amazing role model. She taught me so much, and not only me, but our staff. She visited our offices often to talk with our staff about the importance of being proud of who you are. I could go on and on. I know there's many role models for me that have taught me different things along the way.
When did you know, at a certain age, when did you know that you wanted to get into the role that you're now in a sense, and what sparked that fire and passion within you to get into becoming and pursuing the role of being the president of the Métis Nation of Alberta?
Yeah, I agree. That's the way most things happen. For me, that's not the way it happened at all. I never, ever had dreams of becoming the president of the Métis Nation. I actually grew up very much liking the world of finances, and that's what I pursued. When I graduated, I went into the finance area. I actually became a certified management accountant, and that was what I intended to do. Of course, along the way, my husband and I had a dry cleaning business for 13 years. And that was because my husband was a welder, and at one point in time, he had a health problem, so he had to give up his welding, and we determined that we would go into business, and that's what we did for 13 years. And, you know, it was something we enjoyed, but it had its toll on us because it was long, hard work. And after 13 years, we decided we would no longer do that. That is when I became really involved with the Métis Nation, other than just going to meetings and whatever. At that point in time, I decided to go back in and upgrade some of my finance skills. And during one of my courses that I took at NAIT, I needed to put in some practical work. And I went to the Métis Nation and asked them if they needed any help in their finance department. And that's how that all began. I went to work at the Métis Nation to do my, I believe it was something like 16 weeks that I had to do practicum. And the president of Region 4, Stan Plant at the time, encouraged me to apply there. And I did, and I went to work for the Métis Nation for 5 years in the finance department. And, you know, Daniel, I could have gladly stayed there because I enjoyed my finance career. I could have stayed there and been there forever, but as the Métis Nation was going through a lot of struggles at the time. And even though I was only in the finance area, I saw many, many things that we probably could have and should have done better. There was many things that I believe caused me a lot of concern about working with the nation that I was so proud of and seeing these things happen. And so my decision was, I can't stay here any longer. There's too many things that just don't make sense to me. We're missing too many opportunities. We're doing things like fighting out in the middle of the street, having to go to court to sign checks, all those kinds of things. That was just not proper in my way of thinking. And I was about to leave, and because part of my role as finance director was to go out to our regional offices and help the finance people out there to make sure we were doing things properly, and which was enjoyable. I got to meet a lot of people in the community, and as well as work with the staff in those regional offices. So when I made my decision on my last round, I advised everyone that I would no longer be back here doing this role because I was leaving. And that was when the encouragement from the people came to say, no, you're finally having us do what we need to do to move our nation forward. You can't just leave. Why don't you run for a position? Why don't you this? Why don't, you know, there was many, many things that were thrown out there, and in my belief, the only way things were going to change is if someone set a different direction. Not a different direction in the sense of what I believed our people always wanted, and that was that working together as they did to save the land, to get health benefits for our people. There was so much more, and recognition was a huge part of it, of making sure that we were recognized as Métis people. No, we weren't First Nations and we weren't Inuit. We were Métis and very proud of it. So that was why I guess I became president, was I knew I was letting people down by leaving. And I decided that, well, the only way you're going to change anything is go to the top. And that was a decision that was made by a group of citizens and my family. And that was where it had to be. And I know at the very beginning, I didn't believe that I could win to begin with, because there was never been a woman president before. There was a lot of reasons. But I also felt that I couldn't just walk away from the many people I had met. I had learned to accept that they too wanted to continue moving forward and do better for the nation. And so that's how it happened. That's how it happened that I ended up making the decision to run, with support from those people and my family. And that's how I became president. Not that the plan was ever there. So I know that's a different story than most people have of, you know, like as you say, of when did you know you wanted to become president?
When you came up with those ideas, when they were just ideas on paper first and you presented those ideas, was it difficult to bring that up, or what was it smooth going forward? And once it was fully getting, you know, the wheels were starting to spin, did it catch traction right away? Did it, was there a lot of people, going for this and be like, wow, this is amazing? Like, was it a slow burn, or was it just a fast burn right away for when it came to the Rupert Stein Institute and the other things that were brought up early in your career?
Okay, so let's talk about Rupert Stein Institute. And, when I was still the director of finance within the Métis Nation, a decision had been made by the Government of Canada that they would devolve what was called labor market training resources to Aboriginal communities, as well, the way it was labeled at that time. And the Métis Nation, everyone pushed to say, we need to be one of those. We need to train our people, but train our people for the jobs that they want, not try to make them fit into something that's not really them. And so in April of 1996, approximately 6 months before I got elected, we had got notice that the training was going to, some of the training dollars were going to be devolved to the Métis Nation of Alberta. And so when I came in September, it was really at the very beginning of this whole process. And of course, I don't take the credit for a lot of anything, because it takes teams to make things work. And one of the things that I had along with me was there were other staff members that were wanting to see more happen as well. So when I came back in as president, there was clearly people there who had worked along with me for 5 years while I was working in the finance department. They had worked in areas. And so as a team, we started really looking at it and saying, what can we do with this? How can we make this benefit everyone? And we knew that as much as we did, there was a lot of need out there. The amount that the Government of Canada was putting into the Métis Nation of Alberta at that time for training dollars was not sufficient. So how are we going to make sure we get more? So we did collectively do a plan to say, we need to go out to universities and colleges. We need to go out to all of those places and say, we have now something to offer to help our students.
That was Madame President of Métis Nation of Alberta, Audrey Patra, on Voices of Our People. I'd like to thank today's special guests for joining us, Julia McDougall and Madame President Audrey Patra. Tune in next Thursday for more Voices of Our People on the Windspeaker Radio Network.